I'm Christiane.
And I am Greg.
And we have had... Oh, wait. Let's start over.
Okay.
I forgot to do the first part.
Which,
welcome to the Bowie Book Club. I'm Christiane.
And I'm Greg, and that is kind of important.
Yeah. And we have had a book club for over a decade. We read a lot of books. Sometimes we talked about them.
Mostly we just got drunk and gossiped.
But at the sad loss of David Bowie in 2016, we decided to get our act together and read through his list of most influential books in no particular order.
In fact, in a completely nonsensical order.
And make wild speculation as we went.
So what did we read this time?
We read In Bluebeard's Castle by George Steiner, which I thought was going to be about the myth of Bluebeard, but it wasn't.
No. It was about a lot of things, but only tangentially about the myth of Bluebeard.
Yeah, it took until the last... So it's a series of four essays that were lectures.
Yeah.
And it took until the last essay lecture where I think Bluebeard was even mentioned.
Before that, Bluebeard was just implied, kind of lurking around in the background.
Just like with his blue beard killing women.
And eating popovers.
Okay, we're done with the popovers. Okay. That was last episode.
Okay. I'm going to drop it now.
Yorkshire pudding.
Yes. Maybe we should talk about who George Steiner was.
Francis George Steiner. I wonder why he didn't go by Francis.
Yeah, Francis is a perfectly cromulent name.
Cromulent. Croissants. Comes back to popovers.
See?
You're doing that.
See, I'm going to stick with it.
So he was Franco-American literary critic, essayist, philosopher, novelist, and educator. He was, you know, Renaissance man of the...
I think A.S. Byatt called him a late Renaissance man. So it's like...
The late Renaissance.
It's like the last Renaissance man before the TV signals goes dead at 3 a.m.
And he was Franco-American because his family had to flee. Was it Austria?
I think so, yeah.
And then they went to France because the climate was going to be better than England.
Right, and this was, you know, in the lead up to World War II.
Yeah, so then they migrated to the East Coast of the United States in the 40s.
Right, and the Holocaust was a huge part of his thinking, yeah. And it'll come up in this book as, you know, like a real touchstone for him. But it was deeply influential on his thinking.
You may know him from The New Yorker, where he was senior book reviewer from like 1966 until 1997. That was a pretty long stint there.
And Adam Gopnik has a really appreciative sort of postscript for him when he died, which wasn't that long ago, only a couple of years ago.
It was 2020. It was February 2020, like just before the pandemic.
Man, what he would have said about the pandemic.
Whew. Yeah. Yeah, so Adam Gopnik, he says a lot of people called George Steiner pretentious, but that he was never a pretender. Like, he really knew all this stuff. Like, he knew... He was a polyglot, polymath. Like, he knew tons of languages in this series of essays / lectures. He just like throws out the German and the Italian and the French like all over the place. He's like, you know, like this saying, and then he just keeps going. You're like, no, I have no idea.
Someone that he worked with, Harriet Harvey Wood, described him as a magnificent lecturer, prophetic and doom laden.
Yeah.
He would turn up with half a page of scribbled notes and never refer to them. So he had a big brain.
Yeah, big brain. He was, I loved this bit. There's a lot of people have said things about him, and they were really fun to read because they were both like not flattering and flattering at the same time.
Right. He seemed to be kind of a divisive figure.
Yeah. And he was apparently the, this was from the Paris Review Art of Criticism interview with him. Says that he was, quote, the first occupant of the Lord Widenfield Professorship of Comparative Literature at Oxford, which the Paris Review calls a return of the prodigal because the first version of his dissertation was rejected from Oxford because it was too close to a field that Oxford did not teach in those days, comparative literature. So he basically was like, you can't publish this here. This we won't give you a doctorate for this. And then he snubbed them and came back and was like, I'm going to teach the stuff that you wouldn't let me publish before.
So he became a fellow, and this is my favorite part of his biography. And then he later became an extraordinary fellow.
What an extraordinary fellow.
I love that that's his job title.
Extraordinary. He had a lot of job titles.
Not just an ordinary fellow.
Yeah, he was just, he was all over the place.
And he, I think, in equal parts amused and befuddled people. Someone said that his greatest quality was that he could move from Pythagoras through Aristotle and Dante to Nietzsche and Tolstoy in a single paragraph. And his irritating vice has been that he can move from Pythagoras through Aristotle and Dante to Nietzsche and Tolstoy in a single paragraph.
Yeah, that was a great article. Lee Sigel's R. Steiner problem and mine.
And
because a lot of people were just, I think the criticism was that he wasn't focusing. He wasn't like an expert in a field. He admits it as well. Like, I think he, in that Paris Review article, he says, quote, every one of my opponents, every one of my critics will tell you that I am a generalist spread far too thin in an age when this is not done anymore, when responsible knowledge is specialized knowledge.
And yeah, and you can definitely see that in this book, which is super wide ranging.
Yeah.
And depending on how you look at it, it's either, you know, it's either really invigorating to have this sort of breadth of knowledge all kind of thrown at you at once, or it's a sign that there's not much going on under the surface. And it depends on who you're asking.
Yeah. And that was hard because I kept wondering how this would have felt as a lecture instead of reading it.
Like actually sitting in a room and hearing someone say it.
Yeah. Because I think I started reading it. I picked it up from the library and I started reading it on the bus home. And it was hard to focus on because I had this feeling of like, what is he talking about? Like, what is happening? So maybe if I was like in a space and he was talking and there was that like human energy, it might have caught me more, but I didn't really connect with his points until that last essay/lecture.
Yeah, and I was trying to like list out what the themes are.
Oh yeah, which was helpful.
The lectures, and I don't know if I got them exactly right, but what it felt like he was trying to set up was that, and this is in, you know, these lectures were given in response to a lecture that T.S. Eliot gave.
Oh yeah, he,
you know,
that's
many
right.
years before. It's part of this lecture series.
That's important to note that, yeah, this is like the 1971
iteration
lecture
of yeah.
this. And this is a whole series, like, and every year they have someone come and give this lecture, the T.S. Yep, Eliot.
And it's still going on. Yeah. So Eliot's original point was that great art is created out of a society with a class structure. Like, that class structure is necessary for great art to be made.
It's like the gatekeeper.
Right.
Concept.
You need that curation and you need that sort of framework.
Otherwise, it'll just be social media.
It'll just be TikToks.
But that sounds like T.S. Eliot.
I am known for my T.S. Eliot impression. There's a wasteland out there.
So, yeah, if there isn't that curation, then
there's chaos.
Yeah.
And Steiner, his first point seems to be in sort of...
It's already a wasteland.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of a rebuttal to Eliot. And what he's saying is that Western civilization and the idea of liberal thinking of constant progress has been shown to be a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the fact that the Holocaust was produced from this culture means that the core is rotten. And we see from that, his second point is, we see a fracturing of cultural context. Now, basically no one is on the same page about what is art, what is, you know, what is good. And to try to explain, you know, something like a poem by Milton would require so much footnoting
that
it's almost
impossible.
So far. Yeah,
yeah, we're so
because
far
we're so
away.
Far apart.
Yeah, and I do like that he took Eliot to task because, you know, there's like Eliot ignored a lot of what went on during the Holocaust. He had some questionable opinions. Book of Cats was apparently...
I was going to say, eventually those showed up in a Broadway musical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and Eliot's thing. I remember reading that essay in undergrad, in my English undergrad. You know, his kind of pay no attention to the man behind the curtain essay. Like, don't look at what the author does. Just look at the art, as though art has this like value in and of itself.
Right, and it kind of exists in a vacuum.
And Steiner says no. The fact that someone can work at Auschwitz and go home and play his violin and read a novel means that all that we've said about we got to teach kids about culture and art and music because that'll make them better people. Apparently it doesn't. Like that people right. can still be terrible and do terrible things and participate in these cultural pieces means those cultural pieces are not doing what they're supposed to.
And in some ways he seems to be saying, you know, that we have to examine that the art that was produced from Western cultures or European cultures is completely tied up with colonialism,
yeah.
you know, racial oppression, which seems, you know, like a very modern thought. But at the same time, he expresses, I think, some antiquated sort of views on non-European art too.
Yeah.
Like it almost feels like he's trying to have it both ways of like, we've got to look at like where this art came from in the European tradition, but all other art is kind of crappy.
I would point out, so Irving Howe from Commentary Magazine in 1972. So this series of lecture essays was September 1970 and January 1971. So then Yale printed it in 1971. And so this essay is coming later, but still kind of on the coattails of it. And Irving Howe says, quote, "The author announces urgent themes, names burning problems, dances around them a little, and then avoids every difficulty they raise."
Right, yeah. And the more you kind of look at it, the less that he really seems to be arguing from a solid base.
That's Steiner.
Yeah, Steiner just seems to be jumping around to things that
are interesting.
Right. And then he kind of ends the book with like, what a time to be alive. Yeah. Isn't this interesting how crazy things are?
Yeah, that was the hardest thing when we were talking about it the other day. How unresolved it feels that at the end. So the last lecture was the one that I felt like, oh, finally, we're talking about teenagers. Yeah,
right,
there we
go. Because he does get to like our common cultural context now appears to be mathematical and musical.
Yeah, so this is 1971, and he gets to the point where he says, like, okay, so what is really happening with culture is that we're going from the eye to the ear.
Right, moving from the capital W word to the sort of shared religious experience or quasi-religious experience of music.
Yeah, and I couldn't tell how he felt about it because it seemed kind of like old man yelling at the kids who were playing the loud rock music because he has this like...
He really goes off on it, yeah.
There's this... In the last essay, which is called Tomorrow, he says... So we've already said the root is rotten, so we shouldn't care about culture, but he says, quote, "The counterculture is perfectly aware of where to begin the job of demolition. The violent illiteracies of the graffiti, the clenched silence of the adolescents, the nonsense cries from the stage happening are resolutely strategic." Like they want to burn it down, he says.
Right. And it seems like he's sympathetic to it in some ways, but then he also says, "The mumble of the dropout, the fuck off of the beatnik, the silence of the teenager."
Mm-hmm. That this is like, this is new. It is an attempt to totally demolish the system.
Right.
And it doesn't sound positive about that, that there is this, like, the people who would have, he made some comment about people now gather together and listen to music because they want the communal connection because those people would have been readers in the past, but now they're not readers. They want to connect to each other. And It sounds like that, like, wow, things used to be different in my day.
Right, right. And his quote is, the music store will be where the bookstore was, or books will live on in uneasy coexistence as part of a music emporium. And I just want to pause to plug Hex Induction Records and Books.
Yeah.
Lake City Way, Seattle, an incredible record store with a beautifully curated, very small section of books.
Yeah. There is more of... it's funny that he says this because, you know, there's been this outcry of like, we're losing music listening the way we used to listen to an album. And now we just like let things stream or just hear things on TikTok and just in clips and out of context. So it keeps going where like what he said was going to overrun literature has itself been overrun by social media or, you know, video culture, but they're still there. Like there's all these great bookstores with books and music together.
Right, right. And it just kind of seems like in some ways he's doing all that fish shaking at the clouds, but he kind of leaves it as like, this is a very interesting time. These changes are, you know, are fascinating in a way, which Howe in his commentary article kind of uses to point up that it's a lot of noise without a lot of substance. And he uses the great phrase, tea kettle chopping, which basically means to rattle on loudly and insistently, but without any meaning.
Yeah. I think that was the hard part, that when I finished the book, I was kind of confused how I should feel about, because he has led you through saying, do you see how our culture, our cultural artifacts, our cultural practices are rotten? Do you see? And now music's just going to take over. And isn't it interesting?
Yeah. And as Howe points out too, going from, you know, this culture produced the Holocaust to isn't it interesting is not a great through line.
But I do wonder now, your comment before about how he would get up with his notes to have a lecture and then would never refer to them.
And just kind of meander.
Yeah, I wonder if it is just, isn't it interesting? We've talked about all this.
Right.
And yeah, it was interesting, but it was hard for me to follow where I was supposed to land.
Yeah.
I guess.
And I think the one thing that I took away from it, or the one thing that I guess impressed me about it, was the sort of prescience of his notion of the cultural fragmentation and the move towards, you know, from a reading sort of culture to something that's more visual and more, more musical focused. Like that feels like that's still going on, and that fracturing is fracturing and fracturing even more. And then the sort of, the other sort of impulse to try to preserve, you know, the great works of Western civilization in a museum rather than as a living part of the culture, it feels like that's, you know, going on as well. You know, treating sort of like the past, the works of the past, as an antique rather than something that like is part of, you know, part of our day-to-day thinking about things. Like I thought that seemed really, you know, kind of forward looking.
I was trying to think of that. There was that woman who wrote a book a couple of years ago that was sort of a support of social media, that everyone had talked about, like, oh, social media is destroying literacy. And is it Virginia Hepburn? Dang it. Now I can't remember the name of the book. But
wait, I'll dub it in later. So it'll be in my voice, so it'll sound weird coming from you. But
yeah, that she had said, you know, everyone's complaining about how no one reads books anymore, but people read all the time. They're reading on social media all the time.
Right. You might be reading tweets, but you're still reading. Well, you're probably not reading tweets now.
You're
reading Mastodon posts or whatever.
But it was confusing to know, to feel like, does that count? Like, and it comes around to that argument of Eliot, like, do we need curation in order to say, yeah, that's good, and nope, that's bad. Virginia Heffernan, Magic and Loss was the book. the internet as art. So that instead of shaking your fist at the cloud and saying, there used to be art and now there is the internet, she thinks the internet is art. And it's tough. Like, how would you collect, you know, a group of social media posts next to Milton and teach them together? Some classes do.
Yeah, you got the tweets of Patricia Lockwood.
Yes.
Next to Milton.
Which was basically her book, right?
But
no one's talking, everyone's, wait, nobody's talking about this? Wasn't that
I think novel? That's what it's called. I just got that from the Little Free Library. Okay. So that's on my list to read.
Yeah, that was an intense book.
And if Twitter goes away, that, I think, I'm gonna miss her and horsey books. I still like looking at horsey books.
That's horse pucky.
Hey. But this kind of, this might not be a great segue, but this feels like a segue into why Bowie liked this book.
It's a total segue, yeah.
And it feels like he was kind of torn between this idea, you know, he was an autodidact like Steiner. He had a really wide-ranging intelligence like Steiner.
I don't think Steiner was an autodidact. He was like an eclectic academic because he was like in the academic world. So Steiner's like an eclectic academic. He's all over the place. Bowie is an eclectic autodidact.
Right.
But so he would have read someone like this and like, yes, I'm totally going to engage in this and ask these same questions of myself.
And it feels like he was kind of split in a way too, where, you know, the Iliad and the Inferno are on his list.
Yeah.
But he was also really interested in and participated in the fracturing of culture.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really interested in things that weren't part of the standard, you know, canon.
Yeah, we had read Age of American Unreason on this list, the Susan Jacoby book.
The middle browing.
Yeah, that he was... it was this same question that, like, why would Bowie have liked these criticisms of the very things he was doing to culture in a way? Like, that Steiner is like, well, look at all these people who would have been readers are now just going to listen to rock music. And Bowie's there with this huge book collection, being the person who's making the rock music that everyone is going to apparently stop reading because of.
Right.
Like, did he feel conflicted about it? Or did he feel like, no, you're wrong, I can show you that I'm both? Or did he... Yeah, I wish I could know where he fit in on this in his own mind.
Yeah, and it comes back to like the original premise of the list is that it's not books that he liked necessarily. It's books that were influential.
It was books that were all about teenage.
Right. And this book does tie back to teenagers. Not very favorably, but they are in there.
Yet again, shaking your fist at the teenagers. That was that, yeah. The silence of the teenagers. And that they are... But, I mean, Steiner's not saying teenagers are ruining culture. He thinks culture was already ruined.
Right.
It's just he's observing where they are going instead.
And I guess one of the other things we could probably pretty confidently point to is that Brian Eno gave him the book and said, you should read this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as part of, you know, Bowie's own education of himself, he totally would have gravitated towards a person like Steiner.
Right. And probably gotten four other books, you know, from this or 40 other books to read.
Yeah, he talks about, I mean, you can see a lot of the trails of Bowie's reading in this because he talks about Orwell. He talks about, you know, the classics. I don't think it was in this book, but in that Paris Review article, he talks about J.P. Priestley. But Steiner is like, I know everyone's like hard on J.P. Priestley because he's popular, but he's great. And that was The English Journey.
Right. Yeah. So there's the ties there. So your spider web, your crazy wall is just getting bigger and bigger.
Every time I read one of these books now, it feels like, oh, look, there's all these other books that end up on the list that are like threaded together through these.
And someday we're going to show that map. not today, though.
Yeah. Speaking of other books, what are you reading?
So another Low Free Library find is I picked up a copy of both Wolf Hall and Bringing Up the Bodies.
Woo!
So they've been sitting on the shelf for a while, but at the sad loss of Hilary Mantel in 2022, I decided to get my act together and read through them in the order that she specified. Yeah. So I'm really enjoying
it. In the order that she specified.
So I saw it with Hall the miniseries, you know, a few years ago and really liked it. And the book is, I'm going to say it's better than the TV show.
I had a hard time watching the TV show because I read the book first. And by the time you get around to it, you're like, oh no, this isn't how I see
yeah, him. Yeah, exactly.
This isn't how I see him at all.
But it's a mix of like, it's incredibly like engaging just in terms of the story. And it's also beautifully written. So
yeah.
And I also, I can't remember if you gave me this book or where I got it from. Life After Life by Kate Atkinson. It might have, someone gave it to me.
I can't remember if I did.
But it's a very similar thing.
I didn't read it.
Where
I gave it to you.
Okay, I'm going to lend it to you when I'm done. Another combination of an engaging story, beautiful writing. This does a lot of crazy like time jumps that I'm still kind of wrapping my head around. Mm. But I'm really enjoying where it's going. So two really good books this month.
I read an awesome book that you gave me, the Anna Mill book Square Eyes, a graphic novel that was like so beautiful, so confusing. Like it's like a person wakes up and is unconnected and you can't be unconnected. It's very like cell phone world, but like deeper. It's like integrated into your whole life. Such a beautiful book. And also I'm reading The Unwritten Book by Samantha Hunt, which was a book that I put on my list back in like January or February. And I've like looked for it at bookstores and then always like, oh, I'm not going to get it this time. And finally I started reading it and it's perfect. It's like kind of a ghost story about her finding a book her dad never finished. And then she's like reading it and responding to it and kind of going through feelings about his death and history. It's really great. It's like in this category I've been looking at called speculative memoir. So it's not like straight up memoir. It's like got elements of like experimentation in it. And I just started Liberation Day, the new book of short stories by George Saunders.
Oh, yeah.
He just bowls me over every time when I'm like, I was not a short story reader. And I think it was the Carmen Machado books that the Her Body and Other Parties, which was my like gateway back into short stories. And then I was like, okay, I'll read George Saunders. He just sees the world in a way that no one else does.
He makes these crazy connections.
So fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really glad you liked Square Eyes.
Yes.
I got it when I was in Missoula a few months ago, actually a while ago now, from the Book Exchange, which is a used bookstore that has a surprisingly good and cheap collection of graphic novels.
It was so good.
And as soon as I saw him, I'm like, I'm going to give this to Christiane. She's going to like this.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful and confusing. And you know what else I'm reading?
What's that?
Our next book.
Oh, I wrote it down here as That Dude's Cabinet of Stuff. I meant to change it to the actual title, but
Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonders.
Like Mr. Cagliari's.
It's like, you know, that guy's cabinet.
Yeah.
Lawrence Weschler.
And had you read that before?
I have not.
Okay.
It was on our shelf because my partner has read it.
That's right. That's right.
And it's connected to that museum in LA, right?
Yeah, I haven't looked at it too much, but it sounds like it's about an actual museum.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm excited to get that going.
Yeah, me too. So that's our next one.
So what song do we pick for this one?
Okay, this one
to
we,
play us out.
We juggled a bit. We were going to do 5 years because it's kind of like Manuel's clouds, like because
Bowie gets in at the end.
Yeah, but
he starts hollering.
But like as much as Steiner was like the culture is dead. He's not really like a yeller because at the end when he's like, isn't it interesting? It kind of takes out the yelling energy there.
Yeah.
And the 5 years seems a little more apocalyptic than this just feels like, look at how we have ruined stuff, and now we're just like putting things in our china cabinet and looking at them like they're a museum. And
look at how things are
changing.
I'm glad you took it there. Okay, if it's not obvious what song we chose, it was Changes.
It was really surprising that we hadn't used Changes yet.
Yeah.
I swear we had, but we haven't, so we're using Changes.
That idea of like, you know, the what was the quote about the counterculture? Like, they know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's like, they're immune to your consultations, man.
They are trying to take us out of like what we've been doing. And so now is a new world. And so it's the fact that he didn't really, like, it seemed kind of negative about music losing readers, but also that it's just changing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go. A perfect song.
Perfect.
To end this perfect episode. And before our next perfect episode in about a month.
So read The Cabinet of Wonders, Mr. Dude's
that
Cabinet
of Wonders. Cabinet of stuff.
And you can find us at the Bowie Book Club. We are still on Twitter.
For as long as it lasts.
We haven't really been doing much, figuring out where things are going to settle in. But we are still there at Bowie Book Pod. But we've been kind of directing some stuff, trying out the Mastodon thing, and we are at book club, at mastodon.social. So,
wow, we're the book club.
The book club. Or just
on mastodon.social. Yeah. Okay.
And then Facebook, of course, Bowie Book Club Podcast, and Instagram at the Bowie Book Club.
All right. So we will talk to you again in about a month.
See you then.
Bye. Oh,
yeah. Hey. Hoopa. And my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
It's all a bunch of horse hockey.
Horse hockey? Horses playing hockey?
Yeah.
Wow. My mom always said horse pucky.
Horse pucky.
Which is a puck?
I can't believe...
Like hockey?
Even that basic of an expression I can still get wrong.